words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be pleasing and acceptable in your sight, O Lord our God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Please be seated. I want to talk about the role of gender in these texts. You may have guessed from the cover that we were going to talk about gender. Pay attention to the cover. There might be a clue. We're from a tradition. The Christian tradition is 2,000 years old, right? I mean, almost 2,000 years old. And so some of the texts we read, like the Book of James and the Gospel of Mark, are almost texts that are 2,000 years old. And the Christian tradition rises out of the Jewish tradition, which is even older. And so like the Proverbs text and the Psalm are possibly 3,000 years old, right? And so we're part of a tradition where we do this weird thing where we read these writings from thousands of years ago. And we do it in this central location, and we treat it with honor because we think that somehow, some way, God speaks to us. The Spirit of God speaks to us through these texts. So that's what we do. And that's why we wrestle with them. That's why we listen to them. That's why we rise when the gospel text is read. There's a sense that somehow, maybe, if we listen and we wrestle and we're that the Spirit of God may stir in our hearts and our minds in some way that will be transformative and lead us deeper into life. In the Episcopal tradition, we also recognize that these are very human texts, right? So they're written by men, mostly men, but some women, in a different cultural time, in a different cultural place. And, you know, there were processes of editing that happened and redaction and all this stuff. And so we also get to pay attention to not what the Spirit of God might be saying, but also what were the humans doing and what were the humans thinking who may have written these texts at that point in time. So we have this reading from Proverbs, written by a man 3,000 years ago, about a capable wife, right? Who can find one? I mean, she is far more precious than jewels. The heart of her husband trusts her. She does him good, not harm. She seeks wool and flax and works with willing hands. She brings food from far away. She considers a field and bides it. She girds herself with strength and makes her arms strong. Her lamp does not go out at night. She opens her hand to the poor, reaches out to the needy. She's not afraid for her household when it snows. Her husband is known at the city gates, taking his seat among the elders. She makes linen garments and sells them and provides the merchants with sashes. Strength and dignity are her clothing. She opens her mouth to wisdom. She looks well to the ways of her household. Her children rise and call her happy. Many women have done excellently, but you surpass them all, says her husband. Charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. We get to talk about this. We get to wrestle with this. I know that at the first service, there were many folks, mostly women, who were like cringing at this text. So this is your opportunity to speak back to the text or to give voice to, I'm curious, how does this land with you? How do you hear these words? Yes. Women don't just belong in the home, they're business people. Okay. Other voices.
We don't hear this one very often.
You don't hear this one very often. Probably because your priest always chooses the other one because they don't want to deal with it. And raise the problems that it creates, right? I'm like, no, let's create the problem. Let's step into it. Others. Yes. Not in the Book of Proverbs, no.
I like this one. They read it at my grandma's funeral. And like my grandmother, I embody many of the virtues here. I'm not afraid to be strong. And we try to be charitable. I mean, hey, what's wrong with any of this?
Okay, so you're saying this was read at your grandmother's funeral or your great-grandmother's funeral, and that embodying these virtues are actually, these are great virtues to have.
Yeah, and I have like these linen cloths that my great-grandma spun.
Yeah, your great-grandmother spun linen. And
everybody was pretty darn ecological.
Okay, great. Yes, sir.
I feel like they're like overcompensating, like throwing these random like here's why women should be this way, and here's why women should be lesser than men. And so you get like a lot of Bible has really cool ideas and stories about how to be a good person. And then it's almost as if they feel so guilty that they throw in this like stuff like this about bringing them down the idea of like borrowing a lot
yeah.
The women created.
Well, but it's curious, to your point, is actually the book of Proverbs elevates wisdom in a feminine voice. So wisdom is personified in a feminine voice, which is a curious thing about the book of Proverbs. Yes, others. Hold on, you've had a choice, a chance. Bill, yes.
We've just moved into a place that supplies us with all the food we can eat, but my wife brought along all of her pots and pans.
Your wife is a capable wife. Right? She's... All right. Go, Claudia. All right.
I find it off-putting in the sense that it's rather a towering bar as a woman than that.
Yes, off-putting because it's rather towered bar. And what does that mean? What's the impact of that upon you?
An unreasonable expectation.
An unreasonable expectation. Yes, exactly. Yes.
I look at that first line, who can find this person? This person doesn't exist. But is this almost like wider bar? All of these things are things that women do. One person doesn't do them all, but it's kind of like, there's business, there's creating, there's making things, there's caring, there's
So it's an ideal. Nobody's going to meet the ideal, but...
And recognizing that work, right? That all of these things are work.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're getting at the tension there. Like, actually, the woman as portrayed in here is really competent and capable, and she would be a great CEO for a Fortune 500 company. She could be president of the United States. There is no reason why this woman needs to be stuck in the home. These are skills and qualities and characteristics that would make her a great leader, right? And so at one level, this is not a picture of incompetence or, a kind of femininity that's dependent upon the man in some way. This is a woman who has agency. She has strength. The word capable in there, a capable wife, is actually a mistranslation of the Hebrew. It should actually read a strong, vigorous, courageous wife who can find. That's what the Hebrew means. It's strong, vigorous, courageous, not capable, right? And that represents the gender bias of the translators. This is an elevation of certain qualities and characteristics that it's clear women have this capacity at one level. But then the challenge is, how does it get used? Right? And the problem is, to your point, it gets put out there in terms of, oh, if you're going to be a good wife, this is what you need to do. And then it becomes an act of oppressive. Right? Then at some level, it sets up these standards of oppression that at some level make you feel inadequate. And Mary Ellen. Yep.
It's the elders of the land, so they can set the standards,
Yep, so...
She's enabling him to
Right, and so you're teasing out the patriarchy that might there, that for him to sit in the council of the elders and be respected in the male community, she needs to do all these things, right? And that's an oppressive piece of it. Yeah, Nancy. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and some of that view does arise from, I mean, part of the reason why we are having this conversation, because a text like this informs the Western tradition in a very profound way. So that's why it's worth us considering and pondering. Yeah, Dan. I would, in an honor-shame culture, I would imagine that he's honored and respected, and he's among the elders. Like, in traditional cultures, I mean, older, I mean, men who have shown wisdom and capability and competence are often given positions of eldership and honor in a society. And so it is based on your good name and the cumulative action, the accumulation of your actions in that culture. Yeah, Deborah. Okay, yeah. So what happens if we don't make it so gender specific, but think about these are the qualities and characters, and you think about what this person is doing in terms of creating a home and creating, you know, and providing for a household. It's not just this isn't a nuclear family. This is a family system, a household with extended family members and other people, right? And so in many ways, that's where this person needs those kind of skills in order to do this. You're pointing it. All right, Carol.
This isn't is a sexy child bride or an ancient
yes.
world Esther
yes.
or a manipulative hot youngster.
Yeah. So what she's saying is that she's pointing out what's not here. What's not here, she's not a sexy child bride. She's not some hot woman. She's not, like, what it doesn't say is that a real wife bears lots of children. That a real wife looks good, you know, she bakes the cake, you know, and does the laundry and then looks really good for her man when she comes home, when he comes home.
It's not like a 14-year-old. It's a mature
woman. It's a mature woman, right, yeah. And so it's not in those cultures often, a wife is younger than the man
you.
Significantly. Yeah, Karen. Right? That she has economic ability, right? And economic capacity. Well, apparently at 3,000 years ago in that context, yes. Robert. Your very strong, vigorous, capable, courageous wife.
But also I know that how I view gender roles and things are not how my daughter is. And what that's interesting for me is not just where we are for this, but where it's going to go in 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, there's a real shift around just the concept of gender. What does gender mean in your kids? And everybody's grandkids has a totally different view than what we were raised in. Marcy. So yeah, you're pointing out, hey, there's nothing here about mothering and the caring, maybe because it was written a man. There's nothing about the emotional labor of the household, right? I mean, I don't know. Yeah, Mike. I do want to talk about gender in the gospel text, too, so we'll move on. I do think it is helpful for us. Often these texts get read and we don't talk about them, we don't consider them. We need to ponder about the way we, not only are there these texts, but we come from a tradition of 2,000 years of people using these texts, and 2,000 years of people thinking about these texts, and we need to, and I think it's beneficial for us as we wrestle with these texts to think about these things and say what's saying. I mean, there's some surprising things here in terms of the portrayal of women, and yet it's also patriarchal in some very fundamental ways as well, right? I want to talk about the gospel text. I want to talk about gender in the gospel text. This is, you remember last week, Jesus is teaching his disciples. So what Jesus is doing is teaching his disciples in last week's gospel text. And what Jesus says is that the Son of Man, or that the Christ, the Anointed One, the Messiah, let me back up. He takes his disciples up to Caesarea Philippi, where there's a shrine to the god Pan, right? So it's a shrine to the god Pan. And in that context, he asks his disciples, who do people say that I am? And some people are like John the Baptist, Elijah, others say a prophet. And Jesus says, who do you say that I am? And Peter says, you are the Christ. You are the Messiah. And part of what we talked about last week is for Peter, it's very possible in Peter's mind what the expectation of Christ meant would be that he would be the political leader that would lead his people to overthrow Roman occupation, right? To set his people free. You're the Christ. And Jesus says, actually, no, be quiet. And then he begins to teach them. He begins to teach them about the Christ. And he says that the Son of Man must suffer and die and be rejected by the chief priests and the religious leaders. And Peter, hearing this, rebukes Jesus. And Peter, hearing this, says, no, God forbid that that should happen to you. That's not what the Christ is. And Jesus rebukes Peter and says, get behind me, Satan. Because you want human things, not things of God. He says, if anyone wants to save their life, they must lose it and take up their cross and follow me. And so there's this paradox. If you want to save your life, you must lose it and take up your cross and follow me. So that was last week's sermon, or last week's text in chapter 8. Today we're in chapter 9. And Jesus and his disciples are passing through Galilee, and he doesn't want anyone to know it, for he's teaching his disciples. So again, he's teaching them, because apparently they need a lot of teaching. And he says to them, the Son of Man is to be betrayed into human hands, and they will kill him, and 3 days after being killed, he will rise again. But they did not understand what he was saying and were afraid to ask him. Which I love that. I love it because, you know, you grew up feeling like, okay, somehow you should understand what Jesus says. You grew up feeling like somehow, oh yeah, it's just clear and apparent. And if these disciples are with him 24/7 for a number of years and they don't understand, over and over and over again, the disciples don't understand. So if they don't understand, what makes me think I understand? There's some comfort in that. But they don't understand, and they're afraid to ask, right? They're afraid of their own ignorance. They're ashamed of where they're at, which is curious to me. Maybe because they feel like it's more important to know things than to not know things. There's some shame in not knowing. Then they come to Capernaum. And when he was in the house, he asked them, what were you arguing about on the way? But they were silent, for on the way they had argued with one another who was the greatest. This is where I want to pay attention to gender, because this is a thing that guys do. It's not just guys. I mean, I think women are capable of it too, so I don't want to be a gender essentialist. But it is often a thing that guys do, like little boys, you know, like whose muscles are the biggest and who can run the fastest and who could jump the highest, right? And who's the smartest, like who is the greatest? It's this thing that happens. There's this hierarchical structuring by which men evaluate their position vis-a-vis one another, right? And, you know, I think it's a very, in some sense, a possibly a very mammalian thing where you get mammals who are always testing the males of mammals are often testing themselves against each other, trying to figure out who's stronger, who's more dominant, who's the alpha, right? it seems to be a thing that males do. And I mean, I don't want to church change the women. You get to do it too. And they often do, right? But in this context, when this text was written in a culture where there were clear gender roles and this is a different time and place, Jesus is doing something really interesting here with the construction of gender and the construction of masculinity. I think he's challenging their masculine identity. Right. A couple years ago, I was with a group of guys, and they're all talking about goats. And I was like, this one is the goat, right? And that one is the goat. And no, this goat is the real goat, and that goat. And I was kind of baffled why these men were so, emotionally invested in goats. It's not how I usually experience a group of guys, right? Goats. And then I said something, and they're like, no, greatest of all time, right? G-O-A-T, goat. Right? And it's a thing. Who's the GOAT? Who's the greatest of all time? Is it LeBron James or is it Michael Jordan? Right? Is it Lionel Messi or is it Pele? Is it Shakespeare or is it Jane Austen? No, guys aren't arguing about that part. But they do, like there are lists. You go online and you can list who's the greatest of all time. And, Forbes has an article and Rolling Stones has an article and everybody has an article about the greatest of all time, where it seems to be a thing that we are preoccupied with. Who's the greatest, right? And at some level, it's very understandable. When you see somebody at the top of at the top of their skill level in a way that is just astonishing, like LeBron James or Michael Jordan, and you see these people play, and you recognize greatness. There's something awesome about them. There's something inspiring about it, right? This is somebody who's created in the image of God, and the image of God is showing forth in a way that is astonishing. So it makes sense that we might be drawn towards who is the greatest. Like these skills that we have, these capabilities that we have, it's the goodness of being human. It's our strengths as human beings. Right? So there's a reason why we might be focused on those things and why we might celebrate them and be concerned about them. And it's curious that they're doing that in the context of him teaching them that the Son of Man must suffer and be rejected. Right? Because suffering and rejection and being vulnerable to violence are not things that men want. They just don't, generally, right? And yet that is what Jesus is saying. If you're going to follow me, you must take up your cross and lose your life in order to find it. And so he's like, what are you guys doing? And they're like, they're silent because they had argued with one another about who was the greatest. So Jesus does this really interesting thing. He sits them down, calls the 12, and says, whoever wants to be first must be last and servant of all. We inherit 2,000 years of Christian teaching on this, and so we're like, and then he says, he takes a little child, and he says, if you want to become like a follower of me, you must become like this little child, right? We inherit 2,000 years of Christian thinking on these things, and we're like, oh, that's great. Yeah, be a servant. That's great. Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Oh, be like a little child, right? Isn't that cute? Because children have such wisdom, right? We're called to be like a child. That's not how the disciples were thinking when Jesus says this, because in that context, there was no glory. I mean, there wasn't a Jesus yet, right? And so there was no glory in being a servant. It was a lower status. And there was no glory or cuteness in being a child. That was an even lower status. This is a time frame when, children, there's a high mortality rate. And often children, and you don't expect that your children are necessarily going to live. And so you're grateful when they do. You love your children, but they don't have status yet. They're treated differently than they are in our current cultural context. And so for Jesus to say, well, if you want to actually get this thing and follow me, you need to be a servant. And you need to be like a little child. He is challenging the very core of their masculine identity. He's challenging the very core of their sense of what it means to be a man in this world. I need to serve? I need to choose a lower status. I need that kind of vulnerability that comes with being a child. I would much rather my autonomy. I would much rather my strength. I would much rather my honor and respect. I don't want that. And yet that's what Jesus is inviting them to, for whatever reason. Because if you want to save your life, you need to lose it. And he needs to teach him again and again. And there's another time we'll still have to teach him because they don't get it. And if they don't get it, what makes us think we get it? I was thinking about the gospel, the James text here, in light of this. Who is wise and understanding among you? Show by your good life that your works are done with gentleness born of wisdom. I was struck by that phrase, gentleness born of wisdom. I don't often put that pairing together. What is it about wisdom that leads to gentleness? But if you have bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not be boastful and false to the truth. And again, James is talking there about that tendency of like envy, selfish ambition, boastful, right? I'm the greatest. I'm the best. I am stronger and better than you are. I'm better than they are. My crowd sizes are bigger than anyone's in the world. Right? Such wisdom does not come down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, devilish. For where there is envy and selfish ambition, there will also be disorder and wickedness of every kind. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without a trace of partiality or hypocrisy. That's a countercultural paradigm right there. Peaceable, gentle, willing to yield. Like willing to yield, not having to defend and constantly secure up your rightness. Full of mercy, without a trace of partiality or hypocrisy. And a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace for those who make peace. These are hard teachings. This is a hard path. I don't think we acknowledge that sufficiently in our tradition. And yet what we're called to, it will be fundamentally transformative of the world. Can you imagine if Christians actually did this? Can you imagine if Christians actually lived this way in our country? Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and God will draw near to you. Amen.